and, of course, the National Defense Authorization Act. We sued the president over this issue. Judge Catherine Forrest in the Southern District of Court of New York issued a temporary injunction, and we are now waiting to see whether that will become permanent. She should rule very soon. All of that has been used to essentially, in this reconfiguration of American society, which is really the heart of this book, into an oligarchic state, a neo-feudalistic state, you criminalize dissent because they know very well what's coming as they reduce roughly two-thirds of this country to subsistence level.
You talk about sacrifice zones in your book, and you talk about heroes, like one we had in our news headlines today, Larry Gibson of West Virginia, who just died.
Yes. And we open the chapter on West Virginia with Larry, who saved the top of his mountain, his boyhood home, hundreds of acres around him devastated in mountaintop removal, a process by which you blow the top 400 feet off of mountains, poison the air, the water, the soil. I mean, nothing can be reclaimed. Joe and I flew over the Appalachian Mountains, hundreds of thousands of acres gone, which will never come back. This is what, you know, we went to these sacrifice zones to expose what unfettered, unregulated capitalism, what this utopian ideology of kneeling before the marketplace actually does. And we wrote it off the ground for that reason, because you can't argue with it, finally. And what it does is essentially destroy human beings. It's an act of violence. Within all of these pockets, within Camden, within West Virginia, within Pine Ridge, South Dakota, where, of course, we open the book with Pine Ridge because that's where it's all began.
Explain Pine Ridge.
Pine Ridge is a Lakota reservation in South Dakota. The average life expectancy for a male is 48. That is the lowest in the Western Hemisphere outside of Haiti. At any one time, 60% of the residents have neither electricity or running water, 80% alcoholism rate, because you break these people. You create a culture of dependence. You make self-sufficiency impossible. And then people anesthetize themselves. And yet, at Pine Ridge, and you have these heroic figures, Leonard Crowdog, all sorts of people who rise up like Larry Gibson and fight back. And if you ask Larry about the chances of saving the Appalachian Mountains, he knew. In the same way that Judy Bonds and, all sorts of activists that we interviewed in West Virginia, and yet they fought back anyway, utterly heroic, amazing figures. I found often whom essentially sustained themselves through faith. In Pine Ridge, of course, that was the traditional sweat lodges, sun dances, returning to the Lakota traditions. But it's incumbent upon us to look at these sacrifice zones to understand what happens when there are no restraints, no impediments on corporate capitalism, because they're doing this globally.
The Immokalee workers.
Immokalee is a case in point, and you've covered Immokalee very well. There you have repeated conditions that, in essence, are slavery, because these are the perfect workers in the eyes of the corporate state. They have no legal protection. They have no benefits. They gather every day in darkness at 4 a.m., hoping for work from crew leaders on buses to pick produce. And it's, of course, the big corporations like Walmart, one of the largest buyers of produce in the country, that determine the prices. That is, you know, they squeeze the growers, whose profits get less and less. They take it out on the workers. We interviewed a worker who had been chained at night inside a truck, forced to defecate with the other workers in a corner of the truck for over 2 years. And that's not accidental. When they can't get enough work,
these are the undocumented
workers. These
are workers.
Largely undocumented, Haitian, Central American, Mexican. And when they can't get enough work, because, of course, they're paid by the day, they can't afford the $50 a week. They are charged by this cobble of white trailer park owners, and they have to live near the collection points. 20 mattresses in a dilapidated trailer filled with cockroaches and rats and holes in the floorboards. Then they sleep out under mango trees, literally. They sleep in encampments. And that's the awful logic of where we're headed. You see the forces of economic power, of corporate power, telling workers in this country that they have to be competitive in a global marketplace. That means being competitive with prison labor in China or sweatshop workers in Bangladesh. And we just saw the great labor advocate Islam, Mr. Islam, being murdered by obviously opponents of any kind of labor organizing. They work 22 cents an hour, $37 a month. That's the world that we are headed for, and it comes right back to the Chicago strike because none of the established systems, formal systems of power, including the two political parties, are going to help us. And that was the importance of the Occupy movement. It essentially stated that fact. We're on our own now.
Days of destruction, days of revolt, you started before Occupy.
Yes, because it was an understanding that unfettered, unregulated, unchecked, unimpeded corporate capitalism knows only one word, and that's more. They commodify everything. Human beings are commodities. The natural world is a commodity that they exploit until exhaustion or collapse, and we see that with the melting of the summer Arctic ice, 40% gone. What is the response of our corporate overlords? It's to raid those waters for the last fish stocks, mineral, oil, natural gas. It makes Herman Melville's Moby Dick the most prescient book in American literature. It's utterly suicidal. These are all Ahabs. There's a quote, I think Ahab says, you know, my means and my methods are sane, my object is mad. It's utter insanity. And if we do not wrest power back from these corporate forces, if we do not reverse this corporate coup d'etat, they will quite literally kill off the ecosystem on which the human species depends for life and force all of us in this downward race to the bottom so that the conditions of workers in Immokalee, Florida, begin to replicate the conditions of workers everywhere.
We just have 20 seconds, but from New York Times reporter, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, to getting out arrested outside one of the world's leading financial institutions here in New York, Chris.
Well, I guess that's called the upward trajectory of my career.
We'll leave it at that. I want to thank you very much for being with us. Chris Hedges, who with Joe Sacco wrote Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. And that does it for our show. If you'd like a copy, go to our website at democracynow.org. Our election 2012 Silenced Majority Tour continues this week. On Thursday at noon, I'll be at the Philadelphia Free Library, then to Pittsburgh at the McConomy Auditorium at Carnegie Mellon University on Friday, at 5 p.m. in Cleveland at Visible Voice Books, and at 8 p.m. at Oberlin, Ohio, the First Church at 106 North Main Street. On Saturday, we'll be at Kenyon College in Gambier, Ohio at noon, then at 3 in Columbus at the First Unitarian Universal Church, at 7 in Ohio University in Athens at the Baker Student Center. And on Sunday at 1, we'll be in Cincinnati at the Crossley Telecommunications Center. The tour continues in Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, then back to Washington and Virginia. And you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aramati Nirmin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Masood, Rabbi Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
And it's 4 minutes after 6 o'clock. You're listening to WUSB Stony Brook. Time for Off the Wall. We'll be right back. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall on this Tuesday, September 11th. Yeah, 12 years after the original September 11th. This is Emmanuel. I'm joined tonight by popular demand, Kyle.
Hi, everyone. Hi.
Okay, but you're not joining us inside the board. Keep speaking, and I'll try to fix this. There we go.
Hi.
There you are. Okay. You have to jiggle the thing. You know what I'm talking about.
Did you know the Hope Diamond is cursed?
Well, that's a great way to get the show started. No, tell me all about this.
I often listen to the radio.
What is the Hope Diamond?
Like that.
What is the Hope Diamond in the first place? Let's start there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was listening, I guess, to NPR because they took KXOT off the air.
I don't know what that means.
I liked it because it was KUOW2. And it's off the air. I don't know if they're streaming now. So now I'm forced to listen to KOW1, which carries a lot of NPR content. So here I am listening, and I was listening to some story about the Hope Diamond. I think it's an anniversary or something. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, and then he's continuing to give a little bit of background on the Hope Diamond. You know, everyone who has owned the Hope Diamond has been cursed or has fallen, you know, had some horrible end in one way or another, including the guy that got the Hope Diamond.
Well, who has the Hope Diamond right now?
Yeah, do you know where the Hope Diamond is now?
Don't tell me it's in the studio. Please don't tell me it's in the studio.
That's a good guess.
Oh, God.
That's a really, really, really good guess. Do you know where the Hope Diamond is? It's in the Smithsonian.
Okay, well, it can stay there as far as I'm concerned. I don't make it down there very often.
All right, well, I'm just saying, the owners of the Smithsonian, which would be who?
Who owns the Smithsonian? Don't we own the Smithsonian?
Yeah, good. Yeah, that's where my head went. That's what I'm thinking. Anyway,
not you and me. I mean,
everybody
in the country.
Delightful afternoon.
Oh, wow. Well, that's cheerful news. So this is what NPR chooses.
I've looked into this. I mean, come on.
NPR chooses to talk about this on this auspicious day.
I didn't talk about that. That's what I'm thinking, though, when I'm listening to this, you know, doing the dishes or whatever. I'm thinking, you know, what the heck? Anyway, where's my coffee cup?
Where's my coffee, Kyle? Where's my coffee?
You don't have coffee.
No,
that's
I
terrible.
Don't. I didn't. School's back in session here. And what that means is that everybody is online at the local coffee shop down the hallway, if you know what I mean. And there's no way that I have to make reservations and come here in the morning to get a cup of coffee for
now. I can see it now, yeah.
Yeah.
I hear you. Well, you know what I've been wrestling with is I have a job for a maker thingy, a singer bot maker. I have this little piece of plastic that broke, and it goes to a copy machine. I use a copier. I had a copier that someone gave me, and I use it for you know, like a flyer for an art show or copying, you know, paperwork. Sometimes you have to print things these days. And so anyway, I've got this copier. Anyway, a piece broke. And it shattered into a million pieces, and I glued it back together. But I want to make a copy of it, so I'm trying to figure out, you know, how to make a 3D object. But the point, the funny thing is, we've talked about it on the show before, the point is, to get to the little piece, to get, you know, there's three pieces, so I had to get all the little component parts to glue it together, and then maybe take a picture and I hope make a replacement, because I don't know if this glue is going to hold up. The point is, you know what I found? You know how I got this part? You know how I got to this step, E?
No, how?
I found the service manual on the internet.
Oh, you did? Okay, this machine is how old?
If I must say, should I say the model number?
Sure, why not? Why not?
Well, it doesn't have an internet connection, so... Well, it doesn't yet.
Well, what is it exactly?
It's a PC720. It's a very old Xeroxography machine. And I found the service manual, E, so I was looking at this thing like, oh my gosh, I just broke it. And this was, you know, somebody gave it to me. I think they found it not by a dumpster and then gave it to me. And then I was like, well, okay, I can make an art show flyer. Or, you know, you could do cool stuff with art, but it's not a digital copier. It's totally analog. And I'm kind of into that. We've talked about analog cameras.
Absolutely.
And stuff
that.
So here I've got this copier, and I was able to get a cartridge for it. So I'm trying to, you know, refurbish it. You know, I like fixing stuff and refurbishing and breathing new life into things. So here I am taking it apart, and I found the dang instructions on how to take it apart, how to service your copy machine. And you know, that's probably why somebody dumped it, is they got, or they got some newfangled new digital device, you know, that's got like five machines in one, and they ditched the old analog copier.
Just to be clear here, you didn't find the owner's manual, you found the service manual, which actually tells you how to take it apart and things like that.
Exactly. Okay. And there's several pages in the back which are the actual manual. So this is like a full manual on how you take it apart, how you run the cables. And I don't know if you've looked, even an old, well, a Xerox machine is quite complex, is what I'm saying. So it was very interesting to get, you know, how the cables work and all the details. And you know, that's what you do when you fix things. I spent how much? Maybe even online, buying the toner for this was like $20.
Uh-huh.
So I don't want to put too much more time into it. And I was really loathing having to take it apart, because I was, do I have time? Do I want to do this? But once you have it apart and you have the components out, and you're really like, wow, maybe I can fix this. It seems like way less of a waste of time. But I would only have gotten to that stage, fixing my own copier instead of just tossing it out like we do with so many things.
Exactly, yes.
I only got to that stage by being empowered with the information to know how to fix it. And So
information literally was power.
Exactly. So that's something we've talked about vis-a-vis car stuff. It's another, I like, mechanics and stuff. That's another hobby of mine. But we've talked about having those manuals, and I've heard people talk about, how hard it is to get some of the information. And this is just sort of a parallel example with something as simple as a photocopier.
Well, do you think if this were a brand new photocopier, one you just bought at the store, would you have been able to do what you're able to do now?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I would have been able to get the service manual. And can you imagine how complicated a digital copier is? I mean, they've got like hard drives now and all sorts of scanning and faxing and Ethernet.
Yeah, that touches upon something that really bugs me. Like, we like to play with analog phones, rotary dial phones, 501s, and what's the other one? 302s, yeah. Am I getting the numbers right? The old Bell instruments?
I mean, you could just say 500, 300.
All right, 500 series, 300 series. Okay.
Ballpark, it's like Dewey Decimal. That would get you in the talking about a certain type. Like, you could say 500 and people would know it's a desk phone.
So we could open one of those phones, and even I, in all my ineptitude, could probably figure out how to wire things together and either fix things or change things around. But who can open up a cell phone or a little digital device and figure out how that works and get that to do something different? You can't. It's not possible.
Yeah, I'm lucky. I guess these are old problems, being able to go in and service a big piece of electronic equipment like this. It's not a common thing, not something you do with these tiny, tiny devices these days. SMD, I think, is what the components are. They're the very, very tiny surface mount components, and they're what have made a lot of the devices so miniature, that they're much smaller electronic components, whereas these older ones, they have bigger resistors. Actually, this one's got some integrated circuit boards with smaller stuff, but some older resistors and stuff like that. But just the scale of the devices makes it hard. You can't even see some of the chips or things that you'd be diagnosing and all of that. But what it did do is this type of repair got me making a bit of a clear space and getting some good lighting so I can, dive into it and take on the challenge. So, I don't know, it's definitely cool to have something that's serviceable that you can learn about. I mean, I've never really looked at a copier on the inside before, and this sort of, I figured out how I broke the part.
Yeah, how did you break it?
I was, it kept giving me some paper jam thing, and I kept opening it, and it's a terrible hinge. It only opens a couple inches, but you open it sort of like an alligator jaw.
Uh-huh.
You look in there for the paper jam, and I was slamming it shut, and I think that's what happened.
That's exactly, the copy machine I have. That was happening, and I was slamming that thing so that neighbors could hear it, because, I tell myself, okay, I'm going to stay calm, but, after it happens like 10 times in a row, you really start to not be calm, and fortunately, I didn't break any little plastic piece, because I don't think I could do what you're doing now, But yeah, I definitely am right there with you when you're slamming down the cover of a jammed copier.
Yeah, so that's my story. That was sort of one of the things I've been taking on, little projects here and there, and lots of organizing. And just trying to, I like doing these kind of projects. I'm terribly upset that I broke it, and it was working so well and hadn't cost very much to be a useful resource.
Kyle, it's a very apropos story for 9/11.
But I would say that doing these kinds of little errands and stuff, it definitely helps me think about other projects,
right?
And how I want to organize things, and that's the kind of stuff I like. I love being a bit of a kinesthetic learner, and you know, by taking on this, I can also think. But it's kind of like how you can think about other things when you listen to radio at the same time. It's, you know, similar. I'm always through fixing something like this, even if it's you know, sort of unfortunate or a pain in the butt, it helps me think about other tasks and things that I'm doing and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think any task, whether it's raking the leaves or fixing a car or some other device, it gives you time to sort of meditate and think of other things you want to do and get your mind in a good place.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm eager to see if I could scan it. I'm looking at 3D scanners. I'm eager to see if I could actually scan the little tiny piece of plastic and then print it out. That would be neat.
That would be cool. Yes, a 3D
replacement part. And it's a 3D printing job. Of what the whole MakerBot and Thingiverse, as they call it, is working with these open source projects these days. So that would be really exciting to actually have it, you know, fix something. And I think I've had other ideas of ways I could use one of those devices. But
there's another Maker Faire coming up at the end of this month, so maybe I could send somebody down there to see if they have answers.
Yeah, exactly. Or definitely, at least in my community here.
Absolutely. So yeah, you know what? While you were describing that, I was looking up the Hope Diamond, and you know, you're right. There are a lot of people that have died that own this thing.
It's the political season. I'm not trying to, like, you know, foreshadow or, you know, talk about be ominous, but yeah, it's just worth. I mean, that's what I think about. Is like, you know, the last part of some soundbite. It makes me think. Okay, great. Now, who has it? Oh, us. Okay.
Well, okay. I just want to go through the history very quickly. Not so much that NPR did, but just to give people, you know, the definite sense that if you have the Hope Diamond in your hands, you are probably in danger. Jacques Collet, he bought the Hope Diamond from Simon Frankel and committed suicide. I don't know if he committed suicide as soon as he got the diamond in his hand or what, but yeah, that's not a good way to go. Then Prince Ivan Kanovatsky bought it from Collet. How did he buy it from Collet if he died? Does that mean that he committed suicide after he sold the Hope Diamond?
Wow.
Or did he buy it from his estate? I don't see if he committed suicide before, after getting rid of the Hope Diamond, maybe he was so upset they didn't have the Hope Diamond anymore because he knew how good it was.
Right. He just made him realize he's just a pawn.
Maybe. And
once
certainly,
you have the Hope Diamond, it's over.
Well,
Prince, you've seen it all, and as soon as you lose it, you realize you'll never have it again.
Prince Kanovatsky certainly would have told him he was a pawn, because I'm sure he was a good chess player. But he was killed by Russian revolutionists, as many princes back then apparently were. He must have loaned it before his death, too, to Mille Ladoux, who was murdered by her sweetheart. And then all kinds of other things. This person gave it to somebody who was imprisoned and tortured. One of the guardians was hanged by a mob in Turkey. Someone else was torn to pieces by wild dogs in Constantinople. That's got to suck. Another person died, a ruined man. Someone else was torn to pieces by a French mob. A lot of mobs involved here. Someone else died in misery and want. But you know what? I got to say, if you look at any history of any people, any place, usually it doesn't end well. Usually it ends with people dying one way or another, whether it's torn to bits by mobs or dogs or feeling misery and want or whatever. I don't know if you can blame the Hope Diamond so much, but just pretty much, you know, mortality and depression and things like that.
Right. I mean, you could talk about the Olympic torch in the same way, you know?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, you probably could. Wow. Way to really put a downer on the Olympics, Kyle. Thank you.
Oh, no, the Olympic Committee's knocking.
Yeah, they're going to come because they hear these things. They really do. Wow. Okay. I want to get into today is September 11th. As I'm trying to tie September 11th to every story somehow, into your plastic story, into the Hope Diamond, into everything, because it's all relevant. But I'm not having much luck so far. It was a Tuesday. It was a Tuesday exactly 11 years ago. I'm not sure if I said 12 before, but no, it was 11 years ago, September 11th, 2001. It was a Tuesday, just like today. The weather was very similar to today as well here in New York. Carl, I know we've discussed this before, certainly in person. I'm not sure on the radio, but where were you? I'm not trying to put you, you know, under suspicion or anything like that. But where were you on September 11th?
Oh man.
I'm sorry.
The really long version or the really, really long version?
Let's go for the medium version because it's an interesting story. I have an interesting story too, and then we're going to open up the phones for listeners.
How much detail do you want? I mean, it's it's something I tell the people I remember, and I think everybody has this sort of scary feeling that they remember as well where they were and what they were doing when 9/11 occurred.
What I find amazing is that there are people walking around now for whom 9/11 has always existed. In other words, if you're under 11 years old, 9/11, you were never alive when there wasn't a 9/11, let's put it that way. Am I saying that right?
Right.
You know, or,
they're
yeah.
Right. And they're interesting, it's an interesting generation.
Yeah, I would say so, but think of the perspective where you don't know of a world before Homeland Security and before all the paranoia that took over, and you know, everyone calls it the day the world changed, and it did in a rather negative way. But imagine not knowing of a world before that, except in fables or history books.
Yeah. Well, in any event, I guess I would have to say, yeah, it's funny because it's been like 10 years of politics and stuff like that, you know, for someone that lived through it as a student.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. So I had just gotten out of high school at the time.
Uh-huh.
And I was a college student in Chicago.
So this was your first year of college?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I had been in that town for a couple months. No. Couple weeks.
Yeah, because
like
September, right. Right. So the school session had just started. So there you were, a nice young freshman showing up for school for the first couple of weeks.
Yep.
It's all new to you, a city far away from home.
Yeah.
And then September 11th dawns.
Yeah, I was in a very specific class, mass media and pop culture. So it was sort of interesting to be there in that classroom. That class occurred at like 10 or something in the morning, and I went and I remember that the class had just started, and I guess the TV was on and that kind of thing, and the teacher just basically walked in, and I can't remember the exact time frame now. It kind of put me on the spot, but we were handed out a lot of information for like alternative media sources. But the television basically was on throughout the class, and I think both towers were still up during class. And I remember an hour later hearing that the first tower had fallen, and then they both fell, and
right.
It just sort of changed from there, and there was basically a lot of people being poisoned by dust and a lot of nasty building materials for the next, like, year.
Yeah, yeah.
So I could go into greater detail, but that's about it. I mean, that's kind of where I was.
Well, how do you recall people reacting in a place halfway across the country? What were people, teachers, fellow students, or were you hearing from relatives and friends from far away to see how you were?
Oh boy, I remember being in touch with my family. It definitely put a tone on school.
Yeah.
And me being away. It was very hard to take things... Wow, this is kind of deep. Wow. family and people were a bit shocked or whatever, but it was sort of everybody put their heads down. It was fall after, it was autumn. Mm-hmm. So everybody had sort of, been digging in for their autumn, and for me, school was one thing. So here I am in this, city doing this thing that, we all hear about, or at least my generation was really encouraged to do. I could go into a lot of detail on how I feel about that, but basically, go to college and, this is what you do as a young adult in America to start your career and all of these things. But without being negative or anything like that, I would say that it was hard to take, a meal card seriously. Mm-hmm. And that kind of thing for me in the months following. In fact, I watched a lot of news and I listened to the radio. And if you're an empathetic person, if you feel for what's going on, to me, I personally felt a lot about, well, why do these people feel this way about our country, right? Mm-hmm. If they are the other and we're, sitting here in this country, why are we not looking at the things that are the reasons of why we are... why people feel this way about us, that they would express themselves here, and what, do we understand their religion and their culture? Do we really, and, who's telling that to the people that are coming back and educating us as young people, and that sort of thing? It was, if you're intelligent, if you were smart, it was hard to, go to school and, be in a dorm and just, study and party and all of this stuff, because, I don't know, I'm really empathetic. I was feeling what was going on, and I didn't take it seriously. I thought this has changed a lot of things. I can't just sit here and study and all of that. I had a, scholarship, and I had some help, But thereafter, I ended up starting to work a little bit. I just felt like I had to do something. I felt like things were too fun. It was too easy to just ignore it and be a silly college student. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I guess as a student, I didn't feel people cared enough.
Uh-huh.
And I was listening to this show after all, because this show had just started.
Actually,
around my sophomore year.
Yeah, you're incorrect there, because this show started in 2003, so you must be listening.
About a year or two.
Yeah,
after.
Off the hook, you might
have
listened to.
It was mid sophomore year,
right?
It really tinged my whole year out of college, out of high school and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
With this tone of seriousness.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because a lot of people shared with that serious tone, and then what they did was they went out and enlisted and said, yeah, I'm going to fight for my country now.
Exactly. And I wasn't moved for that. I was more interested in not using fossil fuels, because I had driven a lot in high school, and that was a big deal, driving, and especially on the West Coast, where we don't have an awesome subway system.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of thing. So, I got family that have been involved in the oil industry, and I'm just interested in the geopolitics. What are we doing with this nation building? Why are we in Iraq? Because as a kid, I saw CNN, I saw the first Gulf War. I don't quite know what Reaganomics is. I don't really remember Reagan, but
it's what screwed up the economy.
Like,
yeah.
Like jumping into that as hey,
uh-huh.
I just I was just born, you know, and then, like, starting to build a political perspective around that was very interesting. And so I grew up with, like, the Gulf War. I knew what that was sort of all about. So as I got into college, I was more interested in, like, okay, what is the Middle East all about? What are, and even natural science and, like, geology and where humans interface with habitats and stuff like that. That, like, fascinates me. You know, where, what is the urban interface with the rural? And because I love, you know, natural stuff out here, obviously on the West Coast and on the East Coast, as I've found from spending time there. So the interrelatedness of all these things, like politics and choices in my life, became very present and very serious. And it was hard to just be in school and not realize the whole world was out there, and that, you know, there were people that didn't go to college after high school and stuff, and that, you know, I was lucky, and but at the same time, I felt like this isn't right. You know, I got to do something else. I ended up switching schools and had a whole bunch of different twists and turns in my life path in the 10 years since 9/11. But I'm pleased with my choices, and yeah, I just got doubled down on the industriousness on my own initiative and, you know, things I want to do and that kind of stuff. And
you're also talking about the whole rest of the world out there. You went out and you saw a good part of that world. You went out and explored.
Travel was a big part of it. I worked and stuff after eventually finishing school and saved some money up and went out and traveled a good deal, and then linked up with you and worked on some projects and got to explore some interesting, very interesting places. But that was sort of my growth, because that's where I was on 9/11. That's how I experienced it, you know, mm-hmm. at the timing, like with the timing. I had just worked at, I had worked at the airport too before that, and I was in a different city, so I was obviously flying a lot.
Yeah,
out to Chicago, and I like aviation a bit, you know, being from Seattle. And aerospace in general, but so it was just very interesting, like that whole tone that, like, wow, now these things that I've been using to, you know, get out here to school or to, you know, make a little bit of money in a summer job, now they're weapons, you know, and then trust and all this, it just tumultuous stuff came up. And I definitely, you know, came back out to the West Coast and started to look at what I was doing critically. And definitely I got into fuel and gasoline because of its relationship with war. And at the, you got to remember, like, I was not old enough to vote for the first Bush election. And so we there was that whole decade of, well, there's a, you know, the Republicans were in power and we were doing all this stuff in wartime kind of sense, and I don't really have much interface with that. Because I was in school, I was a student and stuff like that, but I was aware of it, and what I could do was, in my own world, control things, you know, and not just run around as a silly college student, but really get the education I really wanted, and media, just from that moment of sitting there in, you know, in the classroom, getting a graduate student to give us links to alternative media really reinforced, and I'll never forget that professor. I don't want to name drop, but I will never forget him for doing that, because I, in the 10 years that followed, or in the months that followed, kept my ear to the ground and kept listening and kept reading the news and sort of creating my own opinion and That's, growing in yeah. that way. And then making my own choices in relationship, to what's going on in the world, especially if it's things that, like, seemed like they're, you know, I don't want to get all global and, like, conspiracy, but, I mean, I just started thinking about fuel. I was like, God, I bought a lot of gasoline in high school. I was like, and they're talking about this stuff being, like, something we fight over, and don't know, I just started thinking more vertically about my world and, like, you know, food and just stuff like that. And at that time, the whole timing of it, again, being a couple weeks and I just started college, you're at that point when you start thinking critically about your life and the world and what your education's all about, what your career's all about. And that, it was just so keenly timed that it was right at that point where I'm thinking critically about all these events and stuff in the world. And then, you know, as well, thinking critically about my life. And then I you know, started making choices thereafter that I thought would reflect, would be sort of introspective or at least thoughtful, instead of just sort of barreling straight ahead, you know, headstrong into just, yeah, I'm going to be out here in the big city and be going crazy as a college student. It just didn't feel right.
Mm-hmm.
Soured, as I said.
Interesting perspective. I mean, it really did seem to help you grow. So, you know, it's, you seem to have gotten as much positive out of it as possible. And I wonder...
It was serious, right, E?
Yeah.
It was serious.
Oh, yeah, it sure was. But
here it is smacking us in the face.
Uh-huh.
And your radio show started right up there in 2003, and I was listening to that as well as a lot of other alternative media, and I've been following the world and things as I always did, just that much more, though.
I just wonder what we would be doing if that hadn't happened. Would we be as keen on alternatives? Would we be paying attention as much? Or maybe things would be, we'd be even sharper. I don't know. Maybe we'd be looking at all kinds of different alternatives and thinking that they were possible.
It is what occurred. It is what happened. And, yeah, I have eyes wide open. I don't know. That was my reaction. I think a lot of people had reactions to it. Being in that class, in a media class, it totally reflected in a lot of my continued study when I did finish my education. Had a lot to do with, like, where I thought corporate media was headed and what kinds of people that is creating in our country and the interests that define the types of news and the types of stories that the media creates. It definitely, like, the shaping of war and all of that and, like, what was going on in 2001 definitely developed my my critical analysis of, like, media consolidation and big companies and then where I fit in as a young journalism student and that whole thing.
Yeah, seeing the manipulation that is so prevalent in the mainstream and how people can be swayed in a direction just by the way something is presented. I mean, you know, we all knew that before, but to see it just unfold so blatantly, that was an eye-opener, I think, for a lot of us. Kyle, bear with me for a moment. I'm going to go into delay so we can open up the phones to our listeners.
Yeah.
Our phone number is 631-632-9872. That's country code 1. For those of you that are calling from out of country, we'll be back in just one moment.
Hey, this is Ellie from DeLuca, and you're listening to WUSB 90.1 FM, Radio Free Long Island. Hey, this is Ellie.
And here we are. We're back. Kyle, did you make it into the land of delay?
I don't know. Am I in delay?
Yeah, you know, I think the ID tried to play twice, but... Yeah. Now we made it. We made it fine. We don't sound quite as good, but we sound okay. But again, our phone number is 631-632-9872. I've told my story before as to where I was. And again, it was a Tuesday. I think we've done an off the wall on a Tuesday since then. That was 9/11 as well. But back then in 2001, I was doing the other radio show Off the Hook on Tuesdays instead of the current Wednesdays. Yes.
Can I just say, I just want to add, allowed me to really hear opportunities, you know, and not go run headstrong into that media that I was critical of, but also it made me really see opportunities, like with what you're doing and, you know, doing radio and when we're on the road and just calling in now, having these opportunities really made me... say, hey, you know, this is the type of media I want to be involved in. These are the types of media. And really, I was able to discern what kinds of things I want to spend time on in my life. And that's, I'm really grateful along the way to have had opportunities like this. So anyway, I just wanted to add that.
No, I'm glad you did. That's awesome. And, you know, not to, not to belittle the horrible tragedy that took place 11 years ago, but you can survive, you can move on, you can grow. And I think what you're saying shows exactly how you can do that. And I'll bet there are a ton of stories out there from people who think, people who actually don't just follow what they're told, but actually process it inside their heads. I bet there are a lot of similar stories where people have gotten somewhere as a result of that. So thanks for articulating that. That's really important.
Gotten somewhere and gotten together to collaborate.
Yes.
And we tried to have some cohesion in different areas and avenues and stuff.
And the strength,
be eyes wide open with opportunities.
The strength that comes from that is simply immeasurable. Again, our phone number is 631-632-9872. We don't have that much time. So if you have a story or a question or a comment, please give us a call. It was Tuesday. Off the Hook was supposed to be on that day. And, you know, what was weird was I was up early. I am never up early, but I was up early because I was on jury duty. And while I knew I wasn't being called that day, my schedule is such that I would have to pretty much train myself to get up at that time. In other words, I had to be up and ready to go by 8 a.m. to get to where the jury place was. I think it was out in Riverhead. For me to do that, I'd have to start on Friday going to sleep a couple hours earlier every night until I got to the point where I would actually have a chance of getting up early in the morning. So even though I knew I wasn't being called on Tuesday, I had been training myself. I was up. And I actually got a phone call from a friend saying that a plane just crashed into the World Trade Center. Otherwise, I would not have known anything until late in the afternoon. So it was really very bizarre that I was actually able to follow this live. So I turned on the television set, and of course, everybody was confused. Nobody really knew what was going on, what kind of plane. People thought it was a small plane. Nobody knew it was a big plane. And I saw the second plane. I thought, oh, look at that idiot flying for whatever agency, getting too close like that. And of course, that turned out to be the second plane crashing into the building. But, you know, the reporters on the ground thought it was an explosion. They were reporting it all haphazardly, which is what happens in any kind of live crisis. That's why I'm fascinated. That's why I always would tape things live when they were happening, because of all the misinformation that got out there and people second-guessing and just speculating, you see who a real professional is in a situation like that. And I remember a report coming in that there were car bombs outside the State Department that were going off. And, of course, that wasn't true, but it was reported anyway. All kinds of things like that. Nobody really knew what was going on. In my particular case, though, I was obviously following everything, but I was still determined to make it into Manhattan, even though everybody said that was a very bad idea and it was impossible. And I think you know me, Kyle, that usually when something like that happens, I just feel like I've got to give it a shot, you know?
Yeah, just sit in the easy chair and get a, you know, hot butter rum, and you just smoke your pipe and watch and let the world come to your feet.
Wait, have you met me? No, that's not me. That's the opposite of me.
Well, it's too scary. It would be too scary to drive into the city, and you are you're just more the armchair type. You shy away when people say don't do that. You listen, and you just walk away. You know that it's not worth trying to do something. You know that it's futile, and you're better off sitting in your easy chair.
I think you might be joking there, Kyle, because I know that you're aware of many times I've gone directly into the flame just to see what's going on. And this was no exception. I hightailed it into the city many hours early. It was very weird. Not a lot of traffic. In fact, the signs on the parkway said first responders only. I had never actually heard the phrase first responders before 9/11. Basically, the sign was saying first responders only beyond a certain point. And I got to that point, I guess, which was somewhere in Queens. And I forget how I guess the road was just closed. They forced you to get off somewhere in Queens. And I remember driving around this neighborhood. It was somewhere to the east of Jamaica, I believe. And I was just driving around figuring out, what am I going to do? I saw buses blocking Northern Boulevard for no particular reason, just that they had buses parked. I'm not sure I'll never know what the reason for that was. A lot of weird sights like that. And I wound up just parking in front of someone's house in Queens. I remember walking around, and there was a mixture of people. There were kids playing in the street, And then there were people looking very scared, standing on their porches. And I would see things like that throughout the next couple of days, where people were either extremely affected, either because they had somebody in the towers or because they basically were just thinking a lot about what was going on. And then you had people who were nonchalant and didn't want to be bothered with it, or couldn't be bothered with it because they were kids. I wound up walking around until I saw a bus that that picked me up. Wasn't charging any fares. There were no fares on buses that day. And I wound up in Flushing, where I got on the number 7 train, which actually went all the way into Manhattan. And I'll never forget the conversation I had with somebody as we were on the elevated section. And you could see the smoldering ruins of the World Trade Center to the south. There was a Korean woman sitting with her back to it all reading a newspaper. And there was this African-American guy who started talking to me saying, and I forget if he said, this is the pigeons coming home to roost, or these are the chickens coming home to roost. One of those, whoever comes home to roost, he got it. He said exactly what the situation was. This is a direct result of the things that we do overseas and the reputation that we've gotten over the years. Of course, no excuse for it, obviously, but we shouldn't be surprised by it. And that was the point he was making. And other than the people on BAI who would make points like this, I couldn't think of anybody else that would actually dare to say such a thing. And so I made it into town. I got off at Grand Central and wound up on a bus heading down. I think we made it as far as Houston Street. That's as far south as I met with a few friends, as far south as we could get. We had to walk the rest of the way to Wall Street. Not that far a walk, but under the situation where the whole city is in chaos and sirens everywhere and firemen and dust, it was very surreal and strange. I made it to the station a little bit late. I think it was a little bit after when we were supposed to start, because things just took so long, and there was dust everywhere. It was like a snowstorm. It was like that kind of quiet that you get when snow has just fallen, and that was the it was the eerie calm that was surrounding Wall Street. And cars were covered. People were writing notes to each other on cars. In other words, I was here. Meet me at this place. Someone gave me a handkerchief to cover my face because it was just so incredibly dense with what, who knows what it was in the air at that point. That's when we realized that when the third building had fallen, it took the power with it, or something happened that took BAI off the air, or at least took our link off the air. I think we had a carrier, but we didn't have any signal. We didn't have any audio going over that. And we couldn't get into the building. So basically, my trip into the city was for nothing as far as radio went. Boy, did I ever see a lot that I didn't want to see. And we wound up basically just walking back uptown, hanging out there for a while. It was kind of like a ghost town. I think I was up all night, because I remember going back to my car, and it was well after sunrise. No planes in the sky, very little traffic. Just a very strange mood in the city. And that was my 9/11. Very, very weird, very strange, very surreal. Not something I care to repeat, but it's better than sitting at home in the armchair, drinking rum and just watching the news. I had to see it for myself, and I had to report on it for myself.
Definitely.
Yeah.
It's had an impact.
Definitely so. Definitely so. You know, and I want to offer time for our listeners, but I don't think the phones have been ringing. I'm going to give it one more shot, and then if I don't hear back in a few minutes, I'm going to go out of delay, because we sound better out of delay. 631-632-9872. If you think it's a lot of talk about nothing, say that. If you think that we're not paying enough attention, tell us that as well. Whatever is on your mind. It's history, no matter how you choose to interpret it, and it did change the world. And did you notice changes in, well, actually, here's a call. Let's take this call, and we'll try to conference this in. Hopefully, I won't screw this up too badly. And good evening. You're on Off the Wall. Speak up.
Hello there. How are you?
Pretty good. Kyle, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, everybody can hear each other, I think.
I can hear everyone.
All right. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from the road.
Okay.
Great. I wanted to just offer my warning, because I think it's kind of poignant with regard to the way America kind of handles or looks at a tragedy on its own soil, as opposed to somewhere else.
Okay.
I was I was working in a mailroom at the time, and I was sorting mail, and on the news, there was a TV in this particular mailroom. It was a doctor's lounge in a hospital, so they had a TV. And I was watching the TV on Channel 7, and I believe it went to a commercial for Nightline all week. They had a promo. They were going to be doing an expose, an all-week special on 3 million people killed in the Congo in about a span of about 2 years. This was, you know, the Holocaust. They were billing it as the Holocaust nobody knows about, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And right before the end of that commercial, to say even when that was going to happen and when you could see it at what time, it was interrupted, and I saw one of the towers on fire, and that's when the news bulletin was coming in. That was the initial report. It was breaking in, breaking news. And I didn't think much of it then, but I remember recounting it back to someone about where were you. We were having the conversation, which I'm sure has happened so many times today and since, you know, where were you, what were you doing when you heard what had happened. And when I was trying to explain to people kind of the premise of what you were saying, BAI was brave enough to talk about, which is, you know, our meddling in the world and, you know, certain things that go on in other places that we're kind of insulated from as Americans, you know, in recounting where I was and what I was experiencing at that moment was actually kind of speaks to our own, you know, and I don't mean to demean in any way with what happened, to, you know, on this date. But at the same time, you know, the commercial interruption of the breaking news of our tragedy, when at that time, I bet you, you know, I'd be very surprised if 10 to 20% of our American population knew that there was a, you know, a genocide going on in Africa in the 2 year span. You know, there were 3 million people, you know, killed. So kind of poignant in that regard.
And symbolic, too, that it was eclipsed and maybe never even gone back to, and we just remained ignorant of what was going on in the rest of the world.
I seriously doubt if any of the rest of that week contained, you know, a documentary on the Congo.
I could understand the rest of the week, maybe in the rest of the month, but hopefully but, at some point we went back and started studying that as well.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, thanks so much for that call. Very interesting words there. Thank you.
Cheers, guys.
All right. 631-632-9872, that's our telephone number. Actually, you know what, Kyle, I don't think we have time for any more calls.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. Fucked. Yeah, time flies, it really does. Let me come out of delay. I'll join you there in just a moment.
On delay.
What was that you said, Kyle? You said something?
I said on delay.
Oh, okay, all right, because the mic was off when you said it, but I heard it when it came back just now. That was interesting and definitely symbolic there as far as not paying attention to what's going on in other places. Any final thoughts on all this? Because it really is, you know, a day to remember. It's not something that that you want to just brush aside. You should think about how we got here, the negative things that have happened as a result. You know, one thing I do remember, and this is sort of a combination of negative and positive, a night or two later, I was also in the city, there's an Afghan restaurant. I think I've gone there with you as well. And I was wondering, because there was a lot of anti-Afghan propaganda being spread around in the wake of 9/11 in the days following. I wanted to know, is this place going to be firebombed, or are they even open? And I went there with some people. And it was packed. It was packed with people who wanted to show their support for individuals who had nothing to do with any of this, and just to show that New York was not going to buy into any of this nationalistic crap. Also, I saw a video from Union Square. Union Square was where people congregated for true memorials. It wasn't the official government sponsored thing. It was people saying, "Have you seen my brother? Have you seen my friends?" Had signs up, statues, various people just speaking. You've been to Union Square. You know what it's like. Night and day, it was an incredible scene. But I saw a video somebody made where somebody dressed up in Afghani garb was walking through, and people were coming up to that person saying, "Are you okay? Is anybody bothering you?" And I just said to myself, that's the spirit that we need, looking out for each other. Even those people that are a little different, that we might be suspicious of, especially people like that. And I was heartened to see that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Any final words, Kyle? Because we really are out of time now.
Oh, well, I guess I've been officially asked, where was I on 9/11?
Yeah, but not by the authorities.
Letting me share, and I could go on and on about it. I just didn't know how much detail you wanted. I just really liked getting to express how interconnected and how it, like, still sort of is a part of my imperative in life, you know? It's interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah, it helps to shape who we are. All these events help to shape who we are, who we become, what we listen to, what we participate in. And it's something to look back on as a horrible day, obviously, but something that we can't stay there. We can't stay in the misery. We have to grow from that, because life is filled with misery of one sort or another, individual, collective, you name it. It's all there, plenty of it. Whether you hold the Hope Diamond or not, you're going to encounter misery. And you can either wallow in it or you can grow from it. And I think the words that you said and what we've heard from the caller show how people can grow and keep asking and keep learning. So anyway, Kyle, thanks so much for joining us. And we all miss you around here. Hopefully we'll have you back. In the meantime, just keep paying attention, I guess, and questioning things and growing and building.
Absolutely. Likewise.
All right. And that's going to do it for us here tonight on this 9/11, which to us is a day of growth, of discussion, but to others, I suppose, is just another day.
Every day she takes a morning bath, she wets her hair, wraps a towel around her as she's heading for the bedroom chair. It's just another day, slipping into stockings, stepping into shoes, dipping in the pocket of her raincoat. It's just another day at the office where the papers grow. She takes a break, drinks another coffee, and she finds it hard to stay awake. It's just another day. It's just another day.
into stockings, stepping into shoes, dipping in the pocket of a raincoat. Oh, it's just another day. It's just another day.
Yeah, it's 7:02 p.m., and you're listening to WUSB Stony Brook. I was just listening, like you were, to Emmanuel and Kyle discussing, you know, where they were 11 years ago today. And I have to there's a bunch of things that are on my mind today. Just very quickly, and I'm not going to do a 9/11 show here. We're not doing that. We're going to get into the music in 1 second. But I just want to say that, well, first of all, I was on my way to a new job that morning. Not a new job per se, but a new location for a job I'd already had, supervising some people in a location. And I had no radio in my car. So I'm driving, and, you know, I do see that there's some activity on the street, some things going on, you know, where that are unusual, things along those lines. But I get to the location, it turned out, I get to the location, and I walk in, and I see everybody on the staff of people I am to be supervising in the break room watching television. And as I walk in, I say to myself, boy, I'm going to have a lot of work to do with these people, aren't I? And of course, then, like everybody else, you know, the first plane had just hit at that particular point. So it was, there was a brief thing on the news, and the second plane was only going to hit a few seconds later. But I only caught the brief first announcement, the tail end of it. And that was my first experience. I was walking into a new location for a new job, and first day on that at that location, and thinking to myself, boy, these guys just sit around and watch TV all day. And that's a true story. But besides my personal experience at that moment, and of course the many subsequent experiences like many of you have had, you know, many of you lost loved ones, family, friends. Many of you lost people you never met. As Emmanuel and Kyle were discussing, many of you lost people who were, you know, you were too young to meet. But some of you, you know, you lost fathers, you lost mothers, you lost family, friends, children, and it was a difficult, difficult day. And it is very, very difficult. But I do believe, and what my experience has taught me in many years of discussing this with many people, as has probably been the case with you, is that this heinous act that occurred on that day was the act of individuals. Not an act of a religious group, not an act of a country, the people in a country, not an act of a race, not an act of any of that. And in fact, that's what we have to keep in mind, that some people have done some crazy things in the world of all different faiths, all different races, all different nationalities, and they're individuals. Okay. And what really unites us as a group around this planet, as a group of human beings, is the fact that ultimately, we're tolerant and caring. And that's what I found anytime you talk to anyone. There's a mob mentality that can take place sometimes, as we know, but we're a tolerant group, we human beings, overall, with individuals. And that's something we have to keep in mind when we're dealing with politicians who try to rattle sabers and say this and that about people overseas or this and that about our neighbors, okay? That's something to keep in mind, that everyone is an individual and everyone is deserving of caring and attention and understanding. And the biggest thing out of 9/11 is not America united against an enemy. It's not. They try to sell that to you, but that's not what it is. It's the vast majority of Americans feeling tolerant of individuals when they meet them. That's the real message. Please, please, please don't let yourself, people you know, get caught up in this stereotyping, this blanketing, all these different things that occur, whether people be from other countries, people be from here, that are your neighbors, that are different from you, you know. Okay, so it's all about tolerance. It's all about taking care of each other in the world. And that is a crucial, crucial thing. And I think many, many, most of us, dare I say, have learned that from this horrible experience 11 years ago. That it's not about nations. It's not about religion. It's not about race. It's about some individuals who, A, some individuals who clearly had malice, B, some individuals who were clearly duped and misled and lied to, who committed these terrible acts. So let us continue to be forgiving and caring human beings on this anniversary, which I believe the vast majority of we, the human race, are. So anyway, my little spiel for 9/11. Thank you for being tolerant of my opinion here. Let's get on with the revolution. Kids, Finn's Revolution until the 9 p.m. hour right here on WUSB. Stony Brook, stay tuned.